Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Cheryl Allen, a member of the Real Women Run Committee, the organization that is sponsoring our event tonight. Real Women Run is an organization that encourages, recruits, and trains women to run for office. And we're proud of our success tonight being part of that. In 2012, the general election, four Real Women Run participants ran, and one was elected. In 2014, the general election, 10 Real Women Run participants ran, and five were elected for 50%. In 2014, the county elections, six Real Women Run participants ran, and four were elected. In addition, in 2013, the municipal elections, 93 women ran for office and 60 were elected. Of those, a number had gone through our training, and we're very proud of the progress we're making. 2016 is an important election year, and our organizing committee has planned accordingly. Our winter training will be on January 16th, a Saturday, at the Salt Lake Community College, all day, with the keynote speaker being Debbie Walsh, the director of the Center for American Women and Politics out of the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University. Tonight, we are responding to recent law changes, the Senate Bill 54, which was passed several years ago, that allows a new way to get on the ballot through petition, and we're going to learn about that. We think this is vital for both men and women to know, particularly women, though, because currently we only have one woman in our Congress, the United States, and in 2015, only about 15.5% of our Utah state legislators were women, and frankly, this is down. We want to see that improve because the voice of women is so important in the civic dialogue to help us make good decisions that affect all of us. I would like to just mention our partners. This program was started through the YWCA. The partners now include the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, AAUW, the League of Women Voters, Utah Women and Leadership Project at Utah Valley University, Salt Lake Community College, the Walker Institute at Weber State University, Vision 2020, Springboard Utah, and Utah State University. And all of us are working towards the same goal of having a better informed electorate and more participation by women. In addition to January 16th, which has already been mentioned, on November 11th, there will be a meet and greet mingle event for women who are interested in running for office or serving on a campaign. That will be at the Market Street Grill, Cottonwood, starting at 5:30. And on March 26th, from 8:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, we will have follow-up training to our January training, which will be very comprehensive. For additional questions, please go to realwomenrun.org, and you will find all the information. I would like to turn the time now over to our moderator, Lindsay Zizumbo, who is a founding member of the Real Women Run organization. Lindsay?
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you for joining us this evening. We are really excited to hear from our panel titled Two Ways to the Ballot. Joining us this evening, we have Justin Lee with the Lieutenant Governor's Office. Justin has worked for the Elections Office for 5 years. Prior to that, he worked as an intern for the United States Senate Rules Committee working on elections issues and as an intern in the Utah State Senate. He holds an MA in Political Science from USU and a BA in Political Science from the U of U. Taylor Morgan is the Executive Director of the Count My Vote Citizens Initiative campaign. Before joining Count My Vote, Taylor served as an appointee in the office of Utah Lieutenant Governor Greg Bell, where he specialized in elections administration, legislative affairs, and communications. Taylor has held a long-standing career in elections and furthering voter participation. prior to his appointment with the Utah Lieutenant Governor's Office, Taylor worked to promote voter participation as senior staff for the Governor's Commission on Strengthening Utah's Democracy. Taylor graduated from the University of Utah with a bachelor's in political science and international studies. So thank you both for joining us this evening. We appreciate your participation. We're going to have sort of two segments to this panel. The first segment is Taylor Morgan, who will give us the introduction and background on Count My Vote that led into SB 54. And then Justin Lee will give us the process for candidates and the view from the Lieutenant Governor's office. So with that, we will hand it over to Taylor.
Thanks so much, Lindsay. Really excited to be here with Real Women Run. Really fantastic organization. Has done so much good in a very short period of time. And the reforms before us now with Count My Vote and SB 54 really create a unique opportunity now for more people to get involved in the process, whether they be candidates or voters. Looking back a little bit on Utah's old system, the old caucus system, in my opinion, one of the most significant flaws of Utah's system in the past is that it dramatically underrepresented women in our state. Of all registered voters in Utah, 52% are women. Women vote at higher rates, register at higher rates, and vote at higher rates than men. In both major parties in our state, women are also the majority of voters, about 52-53% in both major parties. Yet among the ranks of the party state delegates, in the Republican Party, for example, only 25% of the state delegates were women, 75% were men. So that alone demonstrates a real deficiency in the old system, and I hope that SB 54 now, the goal is that everybody's on a level playing field, everybody has a voice in the process, we hope that people will take advantage of that opportunity. So I want to cover tonight kind of the looking back a little bit, looking forward, what was Count My Vote's goal? What is the future of Count My Vote? This was 2 years ago this reform was passed in SB 54. There's been a lot of uncertainty about this process, about the legislation, because of all the the politics involved and all the challenges, the lawsuit, what have you. Some of you may have seen the Utah Policy article that published today. That it sounds like some legislators are seriously considering calling a special session sometime this or next month to actually change SB 54 and put the power in selecting nominees back to the delegates. There's this issue of plurality, and some are concerned that a nominee should have 50% or 51% of the vote of primary voters, and if a candidate fails to reach that threshold, the proposals that the legislature may consider would then put the decision entirely back in the hands of the party delegates. So in the end, those party insiders would be able to trump the voice of the voters in the primary. And that's a real problem. That's something we oppose strongly. But this is far from over. This just keeps dragging on. There's a lot of challenges. It's clearly a very controversial change. And that's because it's very significant. So we'll watch that carefully, watch that closely. We'll see what happens. But hopefully tonight you can walk away or leave this event with a better understanding of how the system works, whether you're planning to vote, volunteer on a campaign, or run for office yourself. This system is not easy to understand. So we hope this is helpful for you. The goal of Count My Vote in the beginning, throughout our initiative, and today is to increase participation in Utah elections. Very simple. That's what Count My Vote was formed to do, to increase participation, and that's what we're doing now, working to educate voters on the new system and promote participation in it. Like I mentioned, for a lot of reasons I won't get into tonight, certainly happy to answer questions when we get to it, but Utah's old system was very unique, and it was a barrier to participation in our state. And I believe that Utah's prior caucus system was the primary reason for our declining voter participation over the last few decades. That's just an overview of the old system. We'll move on. Again, if there are questions about that, we can address them, but I think the time is better spent talking about the new system and how you can participate in it. A graph just represents quickly the reason, the need for Count My Vote. I mentioned the goal was to increase voter participation. And you can see there how Utah went from being a top 5 state in voter participation in the past to being a bottom 10 state just within the last few years. And that is the fundamental reason behind Count My Vote. Now, with Count My Vote, we really want to make sure people understand that we chose an initiative as a last resort. The Count My Vote was actually formed back in about 2009, and the founders and the group Count My Vote, with a goal to increase participation, they worked first with the state legislature to try to effect change in election policy. That was not successful. So then Count My Vote worked with both political parties back in 2012, 2013. Unfortunately, neither major party passed very simple reforms to the process. So that led Count My Vote to choosing an initiative as a last resort. Now, the goal of Count My Vote was never to run a successful initiative. The goal of Count My Vote was to accomplish policy change. And so we were left with the only option is a state initiative. We then withdrew that initiative once we had accomplished our policy change through passing SB 54 in March of 2013. So we're very excited about SB 54. We feel like it's it's an excellent solution. It is complicated, but it does preserve the positive elements of the caucus system while opening the process to everyone. So again, Count My Vote was there was a lot of broad, widespread state support for Count My Vote. Count My Vote gathered about 115,000 signatures throughout the state, and polling during the Count My Vote initiative showed that about 86% of Utah voters were supportive of opening the system. So this is something that Utahns want. It's a change that Utahns have been asking for a long time, and we're very excited that it's here.
Taylor.
So I'm happy to, Justin Lee with the Lieutenant Governor's Office can talk about process and how you can participate in the system and how you can access the system. From my perspective, Count My Vote, I would just want to say how important it is with this new system. The key to the success of this system is participation in it. If we don't participate in this new system, if you don't run for office, if you don't get involved on a campaign, then this change, it's pointless, really. Opening the process and giving everyone a voice only works if people take advantage and participate in it. So I know I'm preaching to the choir here. Thank you for being here. All of you are the most engaged folks in this. And so please follow through and please get involved. Please run for office and support candidates. Because as candidates are going out there, as we have more candidates engaging more voters in this system, our participation will rise. And then the quality of our policy and our public discourse will rise as well. So with that, thanks again for having me here. I'm happy to address any questions at the end of the presentation, but I will let Justin now take over and try to explain this very complicated system.
Taylor, really quickly, sorry, before we let you off the hook, I know you're turning off your mic. Going to need you to turn it back on.
It's on.
I have just two pointed questions before we move to this process, since you briefly touched on the political challenges that SB 54 is facing. Do you mind elaborating on what Count My Vote is prepared to do if the legislature does change the legislation?
Great question. So we went on record during the 2015 session. There was a bill, House Bill 313, mentioned the plurality concept that would shift the decision back to the delegates after a primary election. We stated then, and I'll state again now, that if the power is taken out of the hands of the voters and given back to the delegates, that is fundamentally opposed to the goal and the mission of Count My Vote. And Count My Vote, if that were to pass, Count My Vote would vigorously oppose it. And if that did pass, then we would consider all options, whether it's relaunching the initiative, whether it's a referendum campaign. We would vigorously oppose that and try to change it back to the system as it is now.
Great. Thank you. One last question. Can you briefly spend some time on the voter turnout and the decline in Utah and how you see SB 54 directly or theoretically increasing voter participation.
Sure. So as we saw with that slide, and as I mentioned for the folks listening on the radio, Utah's voter participation declined dramatically from the 1960s and 70s until present time. We went from being a top five state in voter participation to a bottom 10 state in voter participation. We're a one-party state. That's the reality. And unfortunately, when a very, very small group of individuals in the party delegates are empowered to choose candidates for everyone else, most voters just feel left out of the process. And in a state where often one party wins in the general, if voters haven't had a chance to participate in choosing who that party's nominee is, they feel like there's no point in voting. There's no reason to participate because, you know, the decision has been made. The crucial process in many districts in our state, and if you're in Salt Lake City, it's a different party. Obtaining the nomination of the Democratic Party in a lot of areas in Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City is highly competitive. But, it, you know, in the past, it's only happened among a small group of delegates. For example, there's about 640,000 registered Republicans in Utah. Justin, is that about right? And I believe there's about 115,000 registered Democrats in the state. Among the Democrats, there are about 2,000, I think about 1,700 delegates, Democratic delegates. And on the Republican side, there's only 4,000 Republican state delegates. And so those individuals, that very small handful in the old system, were empowered to choose candidates for everyone else. And the 660,000 or the 115,000, they didn't get a chance to weigh in primary elections. Only in the past 20 years in Utah, about 83% of all party nominations were determined at convention. Okay, so you're talking, less than one half of 1% of party voters choosing for the entire party who their nominee will be at convention. And more often than not, there's not a primary election. So decades of that system resulted in a lack of interest, a lack of competitiveness, and a lack of engagement among Utah voters because a very small group of people were making decisions for them, and they didn't really feel like they had a voice in the process. So we hope that changes. We now have this two-path system where the delegates and the convention still play a role, but that the everyday voter can also participate by nominating a candidate and guaranteeing a spot on an actual primary election.
Thank you. We will now turn the time over to Justin.
Hi, thanks, Lindsay. And thanks for all of that, Taylor. Now, Taylor gets to talk about a lot of the fun stuff, why the initiative came about, some of the policy fights. I'm here to talk about how this thing works now that it is the law. So my goal here tonight is to explain to you, if you are going to run for office, what it is you should expect, the steps you're going to have to go through, what the process is going to look like. Let's go through that. Thanks for being there. Now, I'm going to throw a lot of stuff at you, and let me just apologize to those that are listening in that you can't see these amazing PowerPoint slides, but let me also say, if you have a website nearby or if you have a computer nearby, go to elections.utah.gov, click on the Election Resources tab, and there will be a link to SB 54 FAQs, version 3. There's been that many FAQ versions. And you can see pretty much all of these same charts there. Some of this stuff is like Taylor said, and thank you for making it sound so complicated. It is awfully complicated, and sometimes the only way to really get through it is to see some of these diagrams. So, if you're listening in, you can go to the website, check that out. If not, we can get these to you. But let's walk through the process here and how this is going to work. So this is Utah's old primary process. You had basically a way to get on the ballot. You would declare candidacy, and you would go to the convention. If you went to the convention, and I know the percentages differed across some counties, but generally if you exceeded 60% of the delegate votes at convention, you would then proceed to the general election. If no one broke the 60% threshold, then the party would certify a couple of candidates to appear in the primary election. And then the winner of that would go to the general election. That's the old system. Here's our new primary election process. A few more steps and a few more things to think about here. In the Count My Vote, SB 54 compromise, we created two new classifications of political parties. The first one is a registered political party. Now, a registered political party I'm going to talk about very quickly because no party has elected to be one. So this is more point of interest than any real-world application at the moment. A registered political party, the only way candidates can get on the ballot is by collecting signatures. There's no option for convention. You collect signatures. Anyone that collects the number of signatures go to the primary election. Winner from the primary election goes to the general ballot for each party. That's the registered political party system. Now, the reason we don't need to talk about it a lot is because every party in Utah has told us they're going to be a qualified political party. So, interesting, you know, nice note, registered political party, but you can forget about it. All we've got is qualified political parties in the state right now. Talk about is we've got five parties in the state, in case you're curious. We have the Constitution Party, Democratic Party, Independent American Party, Libertarian Party, and Republican Party. And each one of these parties has indicated to our office, Lieutenant Governor's office, that they intend to follow the qualified political party system in 2016. So if you're going to be running in 2016, this is the system you're going to want to pay attention to. Now, if you're going to run under the qualified political party process, you've got two routes that you can use to get to the ballot. A candidate can collect signatures, a candidate can go through convention, or a candidate can do both. And both of those paths will get you to the primary election. So let's talk about the convention route. This should look awfully familiar to anyone who's run before or has followed the politics. Candidates will come in and declare candidacy. That'll happen from March 11th to March 17th. So if you're going to run for office, you want to keep that clear, at least one of those days, to either come to our office or to your county clerk's office and declare candidacy. If you aren't collecting signatures at that point, you will just go through the convention process. The delegates will vote. The parties will certify to our office those people that came out of convention. And you might go to a primary election. Yeah. Nope.
So really quickly, we are live broadcast, so we're going to hold all questions until the end, and we'll have about 15 minutes to Q&A. But the question was, will the deadline for parties be moved back, and can you answer that question?
No. Now, actually, let me give you the answer. There has been discussions from legislators about moving the deadlines. Where those discussions are at, I'm not really going to comment on one way or another, but yeah, there have been discussions about that. So I'll just leave it there. We have a representative here if you want to ask her about it. So qualified party. So again, we have the convention route you can go through, or the new system, you can go through the signature gathering process. And again, you could do both. But let's talk about how you gather signatures. So the way the law currently sits, so that's what we're presenting. If the law changes, we're happy to do another training on that. We come back and redo these slides. But as the law currently sits, someone that wants to gather signatures will come in and declare their intent to gather signatures with our office or with the county clerk beginning on January 4th, 2016. Now, the law says January 1st. But with New Year's and then a weekend, January 4th is that first Monday in January. So if you want to be, right out the gate, the early bird that gets the worm, you'll want to be there January 4th at 8 a.m., because I know I'll be there, and we can do your declaration of intent to gather signatures. Once you make that declaration, you can then begin gathering signatures immediately. Okay, that starts as soon as you declare your intent to gather signatures. Now, if you want to wait a little longer, you can wait all the way up until the end of the normal declaration of candidacy period, so up to March 17th, to declare your intent to gather signatures. Okay? So it's a very long time frame when somebody could do this. And you can gather signatures during that entire time period. All right? Now, even if you declare your intent to gather signatures, you're still going to make another trip up to our office or to the county clerk's office and actually declare candidacy. So the way the law currently sits, that's two separate times you come to the office, two separate declarations. Okay, so you don't want to do the first one and miss the second one. You've got to come up both times. Now, you can submit your signatures then anytime you have a sufficient number of signatures to break the threshold. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second, but you could bring your signatures in anytime during that period. Your absolute drop-dead deadline is 2 weeks prior to your convention. So what does that mean? If you are a single county candidate, it is 2 weeks prior to your party county convention. So I don't have dates for you because depending on your county and depending on your party, those dates will be different. But you have 2 weeks prior to your convention where you would be nominated. If you're in the state convention, it's going to be 2 weeks prior to that, to turn in your signatures to our office or to the county clerk's office if you're going to be a single county candidate. Right now, if you meet your qualification threshold, you go through all of that, then you will be on the primary election ballot. Okay? So you get the signatures, you go to the primary election ballot. Now, we've talked about you can do one, we'll go back to that, you can do one or you can do both. So if you have all of your signatures gathered and you've qualified for the ballot, we will let you know before you get into convention whether you have qualified for that ballot. So even if you go to convention and lose, you've still got your signatures, you will be on the primary ballot. If you go to convention and win, then you just are really cool because you got both of them, and they'll give you a gold star.
Justin, can I step in really quickly? I think you said this, but I want to articulate. Is there a time frame for which a candidate can or cannot collect signatures, and how is Lieutenant Governor's office moderating that?
Sure. So, like I say, you can start collecting signatures as soon as you have declared your intent to gather signatures. So beginning January 4th, you can declare your intent up through March 17th. The last day that you can do that is 2 weeks before your convention. 14 days is when you turn them in. So how are we going to make sure people are following those deadlines? That's a good question. What we're going to do, and we'll talk about this more, and you can see this, but we will give each candidate an individualized petition packet. So we'll have a barcode on there that will have basically your information. It will be your barcode. It will be your packet. And that's something that we will provide to you. So if someone were to go out and start collecting signatures now, we would know that because you would not have this specific packet that we're going to give you after you declare your intent. So we have safeguards in place to make sure nobody games that system, to make sure everybody gets it there in time. So we'll talk about that a little bit more in depth, but that's the general safeguards. Let's talk about your signature requirements. For a statewide office, if you're going to be running for statewide, regardless of which party you're in under the QPP system, you're going to be getting 28,000 signatures to qualify for the ballot. To put that into perspective, in neighboring Colorado, where you can also get on the ballot with a signature gathering process, you get 10,500 signatures to get on the ballot. So we're half the size of Colorado here as far as population, and we're getting almost three times as many signatures to qualify for the ballot. Just to put in perspective what a big hurdle that is. Not to scare you away if you're going to be running statewide, but just want to let you know this is a very big hurdle to cross. If you're going to be running for U.S. House of Representatives, it's going to be 7,000 signatures. Utah State Senate, 2,000. Utah State House, 1,000. If you're going to be a county office candidate, you're going to get 3% of voters permitted to vote in the party's primary election who live in your district or area. So, on November 15th, our office will run a whole bunch of voter registration numbers, and we'll know what the 3% number is of the people who can vote in your primary. So, this is a little bit different. If you have a Democratic candidate and you have an open primary, everybody is allowed to vote in your primary. So it's going to be 3% of all voters in your district. That's going to be your number if you're a county candidate. If you're in the Republican race, which traditionally has held a closed primary, now, with Count My Vote, they cannot have a fully closed primary. The party has to allow unaffiliated voters to vote. So Republicans plus unaffiliated voters, 3% of that is the number of signatures you'll have to get in your district if you're a county candidate. Okay? Have I completely confused everybody with that? Because I confused myself saying it. But here's the great part. You don't actually have to figure that out. Like I said, our office will run all of the numbers. We will publish those on November 16th, so you will know the number that you need to get in your district. All those numbers will be out there. So you don't have to guess. There will be hard numbers out there. Now let's talk about, in general, who can sign your petitions if you're a QPP candidate. So individuals that are residents of your district who are allowed to vote in the political party's primary election, so again, Republican, that's probably going to be unaffiliated and Republican. Most of the other parties, it's going to be every voter. And then registered to vote in Utah. Now, a really important thing to note is that a registered voter can only sign once per candidate in a given race. So if someone is signing petition signatures for, let's just say, House 27, they can only sign for one candidate in House 27. Now, they can also sign for someone in the Senate district, and they can also sign for governor, but for the House race, they can only sign once for that. Now, the thing to think about there is, so how do we know who signs first? That's a big question that we get. Whoever turns in their petitions first, the signature will count for that candidate. Okay? We're totally encouraging races here. We want people to run to the Capitol doors to get them in there first. But the first person to turn it in, we will then verify the signatures in the order we receive. And the first person to turn it in, that's a signature that will count. So that's how we're dealing with that right now. Just to add to the rumors, there was a little bit of discussion about whether or not voters should be able to sign more than one petition packet. I know that's been floated out there. I really don't know if that's going anywhere. But I can confirm that is a rumor that has been discussed. Whether anything changes, we'll see. But right now, it's just one voter per race. Okay, one signature there.
If I can, I just want to step in really quickly and talk about the signature numbers, because on the surface they can appear daunting, challenging. And having done signature gathering, I'll tell you right now, it's not easy, especially at that time of year. But there's a couple positives, I think, with the signature gathering among the, you know, for the voters that is really important. Justin mentioned the unaffiliated voters can sign a petition for candidates. That's significant because you have that 28,000 number for a statewide race, but if you're on the Republican side, you have 640,000 registered Republicans, but then you have 610,000 unaffiliated voters. So you have 1.2 million voters from whom you can get signatures, and 28,000 of that number is about 2%. So it's not that daunting. And if you're a serious candidate to represent the entire state, it's kind of a seriousness test for those candidates. Not easy, but it can be done. The other big positive that can sometimes be lost is the fact that just imagine a lot of candidates going out there and gathering all these signatures. In a legislative race, if you're running for the House, it's 1,000 signatures. There's, on average, I think it's about 35, 40,000 registered voters in a Utah State House district. And if you have two, three, four candidates out there engaging and talking to 1,000 voters each, that alone will really contribute to an increase in participation and an increase to engagement in Utah elections. So, yeah, the signature gathering requirements are challenging, but they promote engagement. They promote a dialogue. They promote candidates getting out there and engaging more voters. We think that's a really, really good thing. And frankly, I'm of the opinion, other than the fantastic PowerPoint and all the work the Lieutenant Governor's office is doing, I think the best way to educate voters on this system will be candidates going out there talking to the voters to get their signatures. So we're really excited about that and can't wait to see how that plays out.
I disagree. The PowerPoint's so much better.
Can I actually just, since we're on this subject, just, I apologize in advance, Mr. Morgan, I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you explain the threshold requirements and the possible disadvantage that gives to Democratic candidates?
That is a very, very good question. This is something we encountered, looked at carefully during the Count My Vote initiative. The initiative language would have put in place a simple direct primary. The registered political party status that Justin referred to earlier, that's essentially what the Count My Vote initiative was, just simple direct primaries. And candidates would get a spot on that primary by getting signatures from 2% of their party voters in their jurisdiction. So if you're a Democrat, you know, one of the challenges is, in certain areas, reaching that threshold may be more challenging because there just may, you may have a smaller population, there may be fewer voters, you may have to cover longer distances or reach out wider and further to find you know, those voters that can nominate you. But, you know, I think if you're a good enough candidate, and I think a lot of you here are, I think you can just change their affiliation and have them register as a Democrat instead. So go out and get your Republicans to nominate you and get them to change their voter registration. So, but in all seriousness, that candidate voter engagement can persuade a lot of voters, and it may increase the number of voters affiliated with all parties, especially the two major parties. And remember, we have 610,000 unaffiliated voters in Utah. And, you know, for decades, these people really haven't had a voice in the process except on, you know, general election day, and oftentimes the decision has been made. So there's a real opportunity there to engage them. But, yeah, there is a disadvantage in some areas of the state for the Democratic Party, absolutely. I'm not sure how we fix that or address that, but it's definitely a challenge.
Thank you.
You know, and let me jump on that. You know, talk about, we know when you're out there gathering signatures. Now, here's the difference: when Count My Vote was out there gathering signatures, they just needed voters in Utah, just registered voters. Now, they needed specific numbers of voters in each Senate district, so they had to be wary of that. But they could go anywhere and find their voters. They can go to City Creek. They can go to the track station. They could come, you know, library, wherever, go get their voters. Now, as a candidate, because you've got to be a little bit more specific about the voters that you're getting. Going to the track station, you know, going to City Creek is probably not your best call, unless you're looking at a much bigger geographic area. If you're statewide, you can get stuff wherever you want. But you need to get specific voters in your district. Now, that's going to require some organization. And I'm saying this actually as a good thing, because it is going to require you to go knock on doors. With the convention system, you know, the great thing about the convention system, for its flaws, was that elected officials were going and talking to delegates. They were getting into their living rooms. They were having conversations. Now, frankly, to go out there and get these signatures, you're going to need to go to people's houses and get in their living rooms and tell them why you should be a candidate and get their signatures. So this is actually going to be, from that perspective, a good thing for voters. Now, another thing that Taylor talked about is changing people's party registrations. You know, a thing that we find out a lot is that people have no clue how they are registered to vote, what party they are registered with, if they're registered to vote. So going out there and helping people find out which party they're registered with, getting them registered to vote, that's a really, really good thing. And we're actually really excited to have a lot of candidates out there partnering with us in getting people registered to vote, getting people, you know, finding out about the system and getting that done. This is going to be a great avenue for that. So there's a real benefit there. Let's talk about what these packets are actually going to look like. Yeah. So when you come declare your declaration of intent to gather signatures, we will then provide you, like I said, with the petition packets. It's going to look a whole lot like this, just with a different picture probably. You see the barcode on there? That is our specific barcode for a given candidate. We'll put all your information on there. We will provide you with a word version of this, so you can actually put your picture on there. If you have people out there gathering on your behalf, they may want to know what you look like. So that's allowed. Let's jump to the next one. Your petition packet, if you've ever seen a petition, Taylor and Lindsay are intimately familiar with these and love them so much. But this is what it's going to look like. It's going to have lines on there where people can sign them, put their address, put their date of birth, all the information that we will need to verify that that candidate is a registered voter with the party in the district. And then you'll get a verification sheet. Now, this is something that's very important. If you're out there gathering signatures, whoever is gathering the signatures, we call them the verifier, they will need to verify in the back of every packet, this will have to be attached, that you've seen the people sign this, that they are who they say they are, and that you verify that. Now, the person that is the verifier cannot sign the inside of the packet. Okay? Can't sign the inside. So you need different people verifying than signing the packet. But when you come in and declare your intent to gather signatures, we will provide you, we will email all of these to you and say, here are your materials, and then you'll go out and print as many of these things as you want to. We'll give you instructions for how to do that. We'll sell, the specific things, like you need to have a staple three places across the top, really nitpicky stuff, but that you've got to do. We'll give you all of those instructions. So you'll declare your intent, and we will provide you with these packets. You can pay people to gather signatures for you. That is allowed. The only thing that you want to be aware of is that circulators cannot be paid based on the number of signatures submitted. Okay? The law would allow for you to pay them on the basis of signatures that were ultimately verified as accurate, but you cannot pay them by signature submitted or gathered. There's some good policy behind this. I had the opportunity to be a temp worker in the Salt Lake County Elections Office at one point, and people were out there doing an absentee ballot drive. They were getting people to sign up to vote by mail. Now, I got a stack of these things, and I was processing them through like a good temp worker would, and then I started noticing that a lot of the signatures on these were looking exactly the same. Come to find out that the people doing this were getting paid by signature that they got, and so they had every incentive in the world to go hang out at McDonald's and sign stuff with as many interesting-looking signatures as they could. This doesn't allow that kind of thing. It doesn't allow your signature gatherers to get fake signatures, which you don't want anyway, because that's not going to help you get on the ballot. But just something to be aware of as you're out there doing that. You could pay them, just not per signature gathered. All right, so that is the qualified political party process in a nutshell. Now, we're going to take some questions about that, but again, just to recap, if you're going through the qualified process, you can go through convention and completely ignore the signature gathering process. You can gather signatures and completely ignore the convention process, or you can do both. Okay? You have the option to do all of those things. Now, let's talk about some of the rules the Lieutenant Governor's Office is putting out there. Now, everything is not in the statute. Every little rule and policy was not there in the statute. And some of this came from the compromise that nobody wanted to touch the legislation, change it too much. And so one of the things they said is Lieutenant Governor's Office shall make some rules that provides for the orderly, transparent submission, verification, and certification of petitions. We actually were working on these rules this very afternoon. We're going to be submitting those to the state rules process tomorrow. Those will be out public soon for public comment. So if you love our rules or hate our rules, you will have a public comment period coming up here in the next couple of months. But let me just run some of these down for you, what they're going to look like. Our office and the county clerks will not accept any petitions unless the candidate declares that they have gathered the amount of signatures required to qualify for the primary ballot. So that means if you need 1,000 signatures to qualify for the ballot, we will not take any of your signatures until you give us 1,000 signatures, okay? You can't just run in 12 signatures every day to us and expect us to process them. There's a couple reasons for this. One, if people never reached the threshold and we were verifying those signatures, that was a whole lot of wasted taxpayer time and money. That would just be silly to do that. And this way we make sure people are bringing in the full number, and then we can verify that. So if you don't have enough for the threshold, just don't even bother bringing them by. We'll just have to turn you away, and I'll feel a little bad about that. Petitions, as I mentioned, will be verified in the same order that they are received. So, if Taylor and I are running against each other, and Taylor gets his packet in there 5 minutes before me, we will verify all of Taylor's first, and any duplicates that happen to be in mine will not be counted for my my petition, okay? So first one that turns it in, we will verify all of their petitions first, and they will get any duplicate signatures, right? Candidates will be able to check your status if you go to elections.utah.gov. If you've ever declared candidacy before, or if you've ever paid a lot of attention, we post every declaration on elections.utah.gov, and we have statuses in there. We will continue to do that for the petition packet. So let's say your petition has been submitted. We're in the process of verifying it. You've met the threshold, things to that effect. So it will be out there for the public where this is going, and we'll have that status posted on elections.utah.gov. We will obviously notify you if you meet the threshold or if you don't meet the threshold, and we will do that as quickly as we can. The reason is if you don't meet the threshold, heaven forbid, then you can go out there and get supplemental signatures so long as you can turn them in before the deadline. And remember, your deadline is 2 weeks before convention. So if you turn in your packet to us 2 weeks before convention and you are deficient, you will not get another shot at that. You just didn't get the threshold. If you give it to us, you know, a month, month and a half beforehand, and we verify and we tell you you are deficient, you have up until that 2 weeks before convention to get us extra signatures to break that threshold. So we will give you that opportunity to supplement your signatures. However, candidates may not supplement petitions once they are qualified for the primary ballot. Now, some of you may be wondering why that is even a rule, and some of you are devious and know exactly why that is a rule. The reason is, if you qualify for the ballot, the only real good reason you have to go out and get more signatures is so that someone else cannot get those signatures. The first time I presented this to a group of elected officials, they knew immediately that what they were going to be doing. The lieutenant governor has also made the rule that once we hit the threshold, we are not going to verify any more signatures for you. So if you need 1,000 signatures and you give us 5,000 signatures, once we hit 1,000, we are done. You have qualified. Congratulations. We are not verifying anymore. Okay? So this is part of an effort to make sure, you know, the people aren't out there just trying to collect every signature they possibly can so that no one else can get those signatures. And it is also an effort to make sure that we have the time to get everything processed. To throw out, I guess, maybe best case scenario for people who want participation, worst case scenario if you're the office that has to verify the signatures, there's a potential to have 1.1 million signatures turned into the state to be verified. If everyone that ran in 2012 ran in 2016 and everybody went out and got signatures, we could have 1.1 million signatures to verify. You can imagine that's going to take some time and some effort. And so anything we can do to frankly speed up that administrative process, we've put in the rules as well. So I'm not going to selfishly say we didn't put some stuff in there just for administrative stuff, but that's some of the reasoning is you want to know fast whether or not you qualified, and if we have to verify, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 useless signatures that don't matter anymore, that's taking time away from us verifying your packet.
Justin, I'm going to just step in and ask you a clarifying question and then a crystal ball question.
Okay.
You can kick crystal ball questions to Taylor if you'd like. So the clarifying question is, if a candidate submits signatures and then is before the deadline and then sends in more signatures and their opponent only sends in one, how do you toggle back and forth between timeline and how you verify whose packet first?
Sure, that's a great question. The best way to maybe answer is we will verify petition packets in the order that we receive them, regardless of which candidate's coming from. So going back to me and Taylor. So if Taylor turns his in first, and I turn mine in second, but it turned out Taylor was actually deficient in his submission, they will verify all of mine before they verify any of Taylor's extra supplemental signatures that he may turn in. So we will just verify everything in the order that it is received.
It's very helpful. In your opinion, is there a likelihood based on this new system that the state will accept electronic signatures anytime soon?
That is a really good question. Yeah, actually, so a couple of years ago, the legislature tasked our office with doing a study on electronic signatures for petitions. And so we looked at the issue, we talked with the county clerks, we talked with, you know, IT folks, tech people, elections people, and we determined it is absolutely possible to do electronic petition signatures. We register people to vote online right now. We do that verifying people through the driver's license office. So we actually have a secure system in place right now to verify somebody's identity online to register you to vote. We feel like a very similar system could be used to do online petition signatures. So we have no doubt that it is possible to do it. Now, when we've presented this to other groups, I remember I went up to the Senate caucus, Republican caucus, and presented this. And the first question was, why aren't we doing electronic petition signatures? And I said, well, that's on you, senators. If you'd like us to, you can pass a law. So there's certainly the capability to do it. And I think there's a little bit of political will now that candidates are out there having to get signatures to accept that and maybe to go online. And just to talk about some of the benefits of that, you know, someone comes up to your doorstep and says, you know, will you sign my petition packet? And whether this is for, you know, any initiative or referendum or for a candidate, you know, as a voter, you're maybe in an awkward position. I don't really want to tell you no because you're my next-door neighbor, or I really don't know anything about this candidate. I don't know who else is running out there. If we can do this online, a voter, frankly, has the opportunity to look. Here's everybody that's running. Here's all the petitions that I am eligible to sign. I can look some stuff up about these candidates. I could find out, you know, information. I could go to their Facebook, to their Twitter. I could go look at their elections page, find out what their positions are before I sign anything. So we think not only is it possible, there's some really, really great benefits to the voter in doing that.
Great. Thank you. Let's talk about the caucus convention system for a moment. There's this a two-part question we'll shoot to Taylor. What is your prediction of the future of the caucus convention system? And also in that, there is support. Those that do support the caucus convention system say that candidates are thoroughly vetted by very informed citizens. What is your response to that?
I'll take the latter question first. That's an argument that we heard often throughout Count My Vote, that the party delegates were better qualified to vet candidates for all the registered voters in their party. There is, you know, Justin mentioned this, and I touched on it earlier. One of the positives of the caucus, the old caucus system, was that because you did have a small number of delegates in both parties, it did force candidates to go and actually engage and talk to those delegates, whether it was on the phone or whether it was in person. But the big downside of that is that everyone else was ignored. I've been a Republican Party state delegate. I was a state delegate in 2010 and in 2012. And the volume of mail and invitations and free meals and contact that I received from candidates was overwhelming. And it was great for me because I was important in the process and my voice mattered. And those candidates would call me personally to talk to me about issues. But my neighbors and, you know, the other 646,000 registered Republicans in the state, they were entirely ignored during that process. That's fundamentally one of the problems. So the argument that anyone is better educated or more informed and consequently should have the power to choose candidates for other people, I think that's fundamentally flawed. In our, you know, in our system, in our representative Republican democracy, the voters choose those elected officials to then go and represent them. And in the old system, you know, those delegates essentially were an unnecessary barrier between the elected officials and the voters, because the elected officials were not accountable to the voters. They were only accountable to the small handful of people that had the power to nominate them. So I don't, you know, the system is great. I think the more people we have participating, the better. It's very easy to just label someone who doesn't agree with you as not educated or not informed. The reality is everybody should have an equal voice in our process, and no one is, you know, more qualified to, no one should have the power to choose candidates for other people. Everybody should have a vote in that process. And I talked so long, Lindsay, that I forgot the first half of that question.
What is your prediction on the future of the caucus convention system?
Yeah, that is, I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, with Count My Vote, we're still seeing this shake out. We still have a lawsuit in play, a lawsuit that's being mediated. We'll see what comes of that. We have rumors of a special session coming to give power back to the delegates. So it is really, really hard to say what the system is actually going to look like. I think that's one of the challenges is voters and candidates need some certainty. They need to know for sure that this is the system. You know, they don't need Justin's office to have to make a new PowerPoint in a month, right? We need to figure this out. We need to have certainty for candidates, and we need to move forward so the voters know what they're know what to expect. So if SB 54, with that qualification, if SB 54 stays in place as it is, you know, I see the power of the caucus convention system diminishing slightly, but I think it will retain a great deal of influence and power because there will be some cachet in both parties if you're the caucus convention chosen candidate. I think that will be helpful. I don't think that system is going away anytime soon, but I do think the power is diminished significantly.
Great. Justin, we understand that independent voters can sign for Democrats. Can independent voters sign for Republicans?
Yes. I could leave it at that. But yeah, under SB 54, unaffiliated voters are allowed to vote in any party's primary and to sign petitions for any party.
Okay, so under the rule, unaffiliated encompasses independents as well.
Yeah, so yeah, independence is kind of a funny term. Unaffiliated voter is... It's kind of the term of art. It's what we use. Means you're not affiliated with any party. Periodically, there are independent parties that exist out there. That is the name of the party. So, but yeah, an independent voter or unaffiliated voter can sign petition packets for any party.
Great. Justin, one more. Based on the benefits of doing the dual path together, the and route, what is your prediction on the percentage of candidates that will take advantage of that system?
That is kind of the million-dollar question, isn't it? You know, there are weeks when it honestly seems like every single candidate is going to go the signature route. And there are other weeks when it seems like nobody wants to touch it. So I really do not know. I honestly have no good prediction for you on that. I think we will... We will see, you know, I referred to how kind of hard some of these numbers are. I think we'll see a lot of candidates start out the signature gathering process and realize it is really complicated and really hard and frankly really crummy months of the year to be doing it and give up before they get all the way to the threshold. So if you're a fan of the caucus convention system, that's a plus for that. I think people are going to realize this is harder than they expect.
Great. Thank you. All right. One last question to close us out for the evening. I think there's been a lot of questions in the air about, is the legislature going to change the bill? Are they not going to change the bill? I'm sure the Lieutenant Governor's office wants an answer on that as well, as does the Count My Vote campaign and supporters. So let me ask you this. If the legislature does make a change to SB 54 in a special election, will those changes go into effect for the 2016 elections?
Depending how they wrote the bill, probably. I think the appetite from the legislators to change things is to put it in effect for 2016. So if we see a special session bill, it will almost certainly be in effect for next year.
Thank you. I want to thank all of our participants this evening who showed up in person and all those out there listening on the radio. I want to, on behalf of Real Women Run, thank our panelists for joining us this evening and for the great information that was disseminated. I want to remind you at the beginning that Justin mentioned the great resource at elections.utah.gov. Click on the Election Resources tab and you can find the PowerPoint that was presented this evening. Thank you. Actually, if you'll join me in thanking our panelists.